the Biden administration signed a bill on Thursday that recognizes Juneteenth as a federal holiday. The day commemorates June 19, 1865, as a key moment in the end of slavery in the U.S. It's also known as Emancipation Day. But there have been some mixed reactions to the official designation, with some celebration and some criticism. Our next guest says it's a missed opportunity for the American government to acknowledge what's been taken from Black Americans and the more complicated story of the abolition of slavery. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What was your reaction to the official designation of the Juneteenth holiday? If you're Black yourself, does Juneteenth being made a holiday make a difference to you? Did you want something more, something different than that? Are you hoping this can at least jumpstart a bigger conversation? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Clyde Ford is the author of several books, including his forthcoming Of Blood and Sweat, Black Lives and the Making of White Power and Wealth. He wrote an op-ed piece headlined, "Without a U.S. Plan for Reparations, Juneteenth is a Hollow National Holiday." He wrote that for the Los Angeles Times. Clyde, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, thank you for inviting me on your show.
Let's talk about this date itself a little bit. As you point out in your piece, it was a step in the end of slavery. It doesn't really mark the end of slavery. Can you talk a little bit about that history?
Sure. June 19th, 1865, in terms of ending slavery, first of all, on that date, even after that date, slavery is still legal in the United States. Kentucky and Delaware, for example, you could still legally own slaves. And both those places, and including the whole country, really, had to await the 13th Amendment on December 6th, 1865, 6 months after Juneteenth, before slavery was legally ended in the United States. So I don't think there's anything about Juneteenth which is actually true historically. So in that respect, it's really a hollow holiday because it starts based on a set of falsehoods, and yet a lot of people have bought into them.
You point out that one 19th century figure that didn't buy into this was Frederick Douglass, who actually picked another day to celebrate Emancipation Day as August 1st. Can you talk about the significance of that date?
Absolutely. Douglass and many of the other abolitionists in the 19th century recognized August 1st, 1834 as one of the most important dates in the emancipation, or the abolition, I should say, of slavery. That was the date upon which Britain issued a really sweeping, very strongly worded statement about the end of slavery any place in the British Empire, much more strongly worded than Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation. So Douglass recognized August 1st, right up until the end of his life, as really what he considered to be Emancipation Day. And I think that's a really strong statement to make in terms of whether June 19th or Juneteenth should be considered Emancipation Day here in the United States.
Can you talk about that kind of piecemeal process that we had in the United States, the Emancipation Proclamation, enforcement in 1865, amendments in the Constitution? It's hard to pick one date.
It's absolutely hard to pick one date, but certainly Juneteenth is not the date to pick. First of all, Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation in September 1862. It went into effect January 1, 1863. But the fact of the matter is, and you only have to read the words of the Emancipation, the Emancipation only was a statement about freedom for slaves in the states that didn't recognize Lincoln's authority anyway, the Confederate states. So technically, if you were in Mississippi, you were free, but there was nothing about whether you were in Delaware to be free. In fact, you weren't. So it's really, and British newspapers picked upon this really quickly, and they pointed out it's really interesting that Lincoln would issue the Emancipation. What it meant was you couldn't own slaves in the United States unless you were loyal to the Union. That was really the hypocrisy, and I think the thing that Douglass and other abolitionists didn't really like. So part of June 19th was that enslaved people in Texas didn't hear about the emancipation until 1865. I have to say that also is a falsehood. The telegraph was used immediately after 1863 and the recognition that the law went into effect. Everybody knew about it, including the enslaved people in Texas. The problem was that the Texas Constitution did not allow for freeing slaves, and Texans fought tooth and nail, even after Appomattox, which happened in April of 1865, as though the war was still going on. So Gordon Granger, the Union general who issued the statement about emancipation in Galveston, wasn't issuing that statement for the benefit of enslaved people who already knew they were free. He was issuing it for the benefit of those white slave owners who wouldn't give up their cause. That's what really Juneteenth is about. It's not about poor blacks who just were too dumb to know that they were free. That's not the truth at all.
Talking to Clyde Ford, author of books including the forthcoming Of Blood and Sweat, Black Lives and the Making of White Power and Wealth, looking at the federal recognition of the Juneteenth celebration. He says maybe it's not something to celebrate after all. You could join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Clyde, your concerns aren't just about the date itself, but also about what came after emancipation, whichever date we pick. Can you talk about the concerns you have about beyond that date and why we should still be thinking about it today?
Absolutely. I mean, on Juneteenth, by the time of Juneteenth, what was going on in the United States was this incredible retreat from the first ever widespread act of reparations for slavery. Shortly after, well, first of all, you got to go back to emancipation. Nothing in the emancipation has a plan for what to do with freeing African Americans who were enslaved, other than Lincoln said, well, I hope you get some jobs. If not, maybe you can join the Union Army. But by the way, don't be angry and don't be violent. That's all that was said. The South actually had a plan for what to do with slaves if they won. It was kind of a bizarre plan, but at least it was a plan. So what was put into place and what Lincoln agreed to, one of his generals actually put this into place, General Sherman, was what we technically know, what's come to be popularly known as 40 acres and a mule. And what was behind that was that there was almost 1 million acres of prime farmland that would be given to African Americans because it was taken away from white slave owners. That's the form of reparations. The problem was, Rob, that when Lincoln was killed and Andrew Johnson became president, one of the things he did just around the time of Juneteenth was to pull back and actually negate that 40 acres and a mule plan, also called Special Orders 15, and say, sorry, we're not going to do that. In fact, even though African Americans had started to settle the land that they were supposedly given, Johnson's order forced them to then be taken away from that land. And really, it's this incredible retrenchment on the idea that reparation should be given. So I really see that as one of the most problematic elements of that time, is that the United States started down a road towards reparations for slavery. And because Lincoln was killed, they then decided to do an about face and walk the other way.
Here we are, 2021. Do you see a path toward making up for that, toward a new reparation?
Sure. I think there's a number of things to consider. And first is, at a local and state level, there have been a number of instances where a city, let's say like Evanston, Illinois, had actually said, look, we really would like to do something that makes up for the way in which African-Americans have been treated in terms of redlining and other things in terms of discrimination. So I think, in fact, in Evanston, they've actually established an ordinance which issues, I think, $25,000 to African-American families. There are a number of states around the country, Virginia being one, in which is looking at, you know, what could they do in terms of reparations. I think all that's good. I think that's positive. But I think there is a national response that goes right back to the Juneteenth that ought to be considered. The efforts that were made in terms of reparations, 40 acres and a mule, also called Special Orders 15, that ought to be followed through. The 1 million acres that was destined by that order to be given to African Americans What should happen now is we should appraise the value of that land. There's all sorts of development and houses, because all this is prime coastal land. The land is probably worth billions, if not trillions of dollars. And that should be the starting point for a discussion about a reparations plan for African Americans. We started down the road. In fact, it was Republicans, all Lincoln Republicans, and many Republicans today try to wrap themselves in the mantle of Abraham Lincoln. Well, they should. They should wrap themselves in the mantle of Abraham Lincoln actually agreeing to a plan for reparations to African Americans and revise the plan. It's still there. It's in the congressional records. The land that was allocated, again, should be appraised. And the value today should be the basis for talking about a reparations plan to African Americans.
We're picking up our conversation now with Clyde Ford, author of several books. He wrote the op-ed piece, Without a U.S. Plan for Reparations, Juneteenth is a hollow national holiday, for the L.A. Times. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org with your thoughts on Juneteenth and the idea of reparations. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Clyde, a common reaction, I think, from white people in particular, when there have been conversations about reparations is, you know, I wasn't around during slave times. My ancestors, somebody might say, came over after 1865. Why should I be on the hook, in effect, as a taxpayer for reparations? What do you say to that argument?
You know, what I say to that is, look, the U.S. Constitution was established in 1787. A lot of people weren't around then, yet we still abide by the laws of the Constitution. We have a democracy not just based on who was here when the laws were created, but who chooses to come to this country and therefore be subject to the laws and the history that was present and created the environment for them. So the fact of the matter is that whether you came before slavery or after slavery, slavery is the basis for establishing a lot of the wealth that took place in this country that was accrued by whites, that wasn't accrued by blacks. And the very fact of the privileges and opportunities given to you by this country is because those very same privileges and opportunities weren't given to another group of people. So regardless of when you came, the idea that reparations is owed to African Americans, I think, is a valid argument. We certainly did it with Japanese during the war, and there are many people who had nothing to do with that, yet still the country decided that that was something worthy to do.
Let's go to our callers now. Kenneth is with us in Janesville. Kenneth, hi.
And that army was an occupational army by that time in Texas, but there was a lot of skullduggery going around, I'm sure. And I first heard the proclamation today made by the army in 1865 on Juneteenth. And they were told that they would become employees immediately. But as bad as it sounds, could the slaveholder say, you know, I paid for you, you're going to have to work off what I paid before I'm going to start giving you more money?
Kenneth, thanks for the call. Clyde, you write some about the condition of black people in the South after they were freed. Were they, in effect, forced into labor?
Oh, absolutely. The period after slavery, you know, that period where blacks were no longer slaves, but were actually sharecroppers. Actually, it was just slavery in another name. Blacks were in essentially a company store where white slave owners were now simply their employers, who basically said, okay, you got to work for me, but you also have to pay for everything, your lodging, your food, and everything else. And the overseers, who were once overseers under slavery, simply became the labor bosses during this time of sharecropping. So right after the Civil War, there was little change. I mean, Jim Crow took place, and you had all these egregious laws of voter suppression, some of the things you even see going on right now in the country in terms of retrenching or retreating from widespread voting. Those were happening right after slavery. So absolutely, African Americans were struggling. It wasn't just everything was great because of the Emancipation Proclamation.
Thanks for the call, Kenneth. We'll go now to Bill in Superior. Bill, hi.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Say, slavery was a horrible, horrible thing that happened in our history, or any history for that matter, and we need to learn from the mistakes that were made in the past. However, the idea of reparation, I feel, is ridiculous, being the fact that nobody in today's society had absolutely anything to do with what happened back then. It's kind of as if you were to say that my great-great-great uncle rode a horse for Wells Fargo, and Wells Fargo promised him a pension when he got to a certain age, but they didn't give him that pension. Now I'm entitled to that pension. That's a ridiculous argument.
Bill, thanks for the call. Clyde?
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, and certainly you hear that a lot, but the challenge is that wealth in this country is built upon historical wealth in families. And the historical wealth in families was denied to those who were denied the opportunity to build wealth, like the enslaved black men and women in this country. So had those people actually been working for wages, just like that fellow who was riding for Wells Fargo, then they would have accrued to themselves and passed on to their family a wealth which we would now see no longer this huge income gap between black and white families. So that's the basis for this. Not just that they're owed for the hardships, but the fact is that they were denied the opportunity to generate wealth that everybody else was given that opportunity to do, and therefore right now they are not in an equitable position in terms of income and in terms of wealth. That's what the basis of a reparations argument is.
Bill, thanks a lot for that call, and Clyde, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, I really appreciate it. Look forward to coming back on Central Time sometime in the future.
That's Clyde Ford, author of several books, including his forthcoming Of Blood and Sweat, Black Lives and the Making of White Power and Wealth. He wrote an op-ed for the LA Times about Juneteenth and reparations.